Well, this will be a bit about growth and cancer and control of cell proliferation, all sort of rolled into one problem. So what I'd like to do is tell you about a gene that we've been working on for more years than I care to admit. Perhaps only Arnie has been working on one gene longer than I have. Arnie's P53. We've been working on an oncogene that's called MYC, or M-Y-C. And this was a gene that was first identified as a transforming gene, or a cancer gene, in retroviruses that had been isolated in the 1930s, actually, and which caused very acute leukemias and lymphomas in animals. And with the advent of molecular biology, people cloned the gene that this retrovirus carried that was responsible for those tumors, and found, as it was found for other oncogenes, that it actually was a normal cellular gene that had been transduced or captured by the retrovirus. But these retroviruses have, in essence, purified interesting genes for us, which are involved in control of the cell, and are in fact deeply involved in human cancers as well. And MYC is one of those. And so we've been working on trying to understand what MYC does for quite a few years. And what I'd like to do in the lecture is give you a bit of background, try to sort of fill you in on why we think it's a particularly interesting problem, and then try to tell you what we've learned over the last 10 years, and concentrate primarily on how we believe MYC exerts its effects on cell growth through its target genes and its binding sites, the genes that it regulates because it's a transcription factor, and its binding sites. And I'm going to take you up to some very new data, which has not been published yet and which we're still wrestling with. So I'll take you up to the very edge that we're at, and we can all stare into the abyss together. And it is kind of an abyss, because it's a surprising result, at least to me. So let me start off then with a bit of background. Okay, so MYC has, you can think of MYC as a good guy and a bad guy. The good aspect of MYC is, as it's expressed normally in essentially every proliferating cell in the body, in all cells in many, many different organisms, as I'll tell you in a few minutes, it's highly conserved. And it's expressed at low level and essentially in all proliferating cells. And the things that are important to remember about it are that it's a highly regulated gene. It's expressed, at quite low level. Estimates vary about between 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 molecules per cell in normal proliferating cells. And what's important to remember is that it's regulated. It's a highly regulated gene. So at one level, it's regulated by the environment. Almost every growth factor, mitogen, or cytokine that you can think of turns on MYC. And in some cases, in the case of TGF-beta, for example, in fibroblast cells, turns it off. So it's highly regulated by growth factor pathways. And most of those pathways that regulate MYC are essentially hardwired. And so that it's not a secondary or tertiary response, but it's a fairly direct response. In other words, MYC is induced even in the absence of any intervening protein synthesis. So it suggests that many pathways are targeting MYC. Of course, they target other genes as well, but many of these pathways target MYC and induce MYC. MYC is under very, very tight control at almost every level you can think of. So for example, there's a large regulatory region which is involved in the initiation of transcription. And many more transcripts actually initiate and start to travel across the gene than actually wind up finishing. So you get many incomplete transcripts, and that's a level of control. In some cases, those incomplete transcripts are completed, for example, when growth factors come along, and so you increase the level of MYC. So at the level of transcription initiation and attenuation of transcription across the gene, MYC is regulated. The RNA itself that's produced by MYC also has a very short half-life, And finally, the protein itself, as we can get into later, has an extremely short half-life of between 20 and 25 minutes. So this, you get the feeling that this is a gene whose product the cell wants to keep under very tight control.
So how is actually your elongation controlled?
I'm sorry?
How is controlled, I mean, that you have an incomplete transcript?
It's not clear. There are pause sites of polymerase in the gene. There are pause sites here, and there are probably pause sites in the second intron. And that's the place where a number of transcripts seem to fall off, and those RNAs get degraded. And you can do experiments to try to keep them to analyze.
The statement that in order to get full transcripts, you need some additional proteins, which would say rescue. From this pulse.
Possibly. Yeah. Or you need to inhibit whatever it is that's pushing polymerase off the gene. Nobody knows. There's very little known about the mechanism.
Are these pause sites intrinsic to the DNA sequence, or there are histones or something on the stuff blocking the stuff into progress?
No one knows. I'd say the mechanics of transcriptional attenuation are a mystery. I don't think anybody is clear on how exactly that happens. So it's really unknown. In fact, it's fair to say that the level, although I've drawn all these arrows, nobody has really parsed what the factors are that are binding MYC and turning it on. And I think the usual promoter bashing experiments that molecular biologists are very good at in defining promoter regions and binding sites hasn't actually worked very well for MYC. And I think part of the reason is because much of the control is at levels of RNA processing and stability and attenuation, and we have no idea what the mechanism is. So it's been very difficult to actually, you can go down these pathways, but at a certain point you stop, and you don't know what's actually regulating it.
Bart? I mean, is the growth factor species specific or are there combinatorial effects? Are there several of them necessary in the human tissue, or?
I would say that has not been carefully looked at. I don't know. Most people throw serum on cells and you see a rapid induction of MYC. And over the years, people have been defining individual factors such as Wnt signaling, sonic hedgehog signaling, PDGF, showing that it turns on MYC in conjunction with cell proliferation, and that's a direct effect, an early, immediate early effect. But I would say there hasn't been a lot of work of the people kind of combining things and seeing what happens. So I don't actually know the answer to that. The expression of MYC is tightly coupled to cell growth, as I'll tell you, and to cell proliferation. So, what kind of happens? So, as I'll show you in a minute, when you have quiescent cells that are not growing or not proliferating, and you add a factor, one of these factors to them, or you add serum to them, in those cells, there's really no MYC being expressed at the RNA or protein level, and then you see a very rapid induction of MYC as cells enter the cell cycle. And if you block that induction, then cells will not enter the cycle. So it seems to be required for cell cycle entry. And you can use, and then in addition, if you artificially activate MYC in quiescent cells, you can get the cells to enter the cycle. So it seems to be sufficient to do that. But in fact, it's not a normal cycle, and the cells often wind up dying, undergoing apoptosis, if there are not other factors around. On the other hand, when cells become terminally differentiated, then MYC levels go down. Right? So it's predominantly, this expression is predominantly associated with cells that are actually cycling and proliferating. So what's very interesting about this is that I've tried to impress on you all these kinds of tight controls. When those controls go awry, what you have is a very strong association with many, many different types of cancers and neoplastic disease. So, of course, there you can imagine overexpression or constitutive activation of signaling pathways, which would lead to constitutive activation of MYC, and that happens. But there are also things that happen to the MYC gene, and I'll go through them in a minute, which really separate the regulatory regions of MYC from its normal physiological regulators, and MYC becomes overexpressed and can't be turned off. And this situation leads to tumorigenesis. So MYC is involved in the etiology of many tumors, often to apoptosis, depending on what the environment looks like, a block to differentiation, so that turnoff of MYC during differentiation is required, and also to genomic instability. And the connections there are very, very vague and very controversial, but they're out there, and I'll just put it on the list.
And I'm sorry, but what vaguely do you mean by genomic instability?
Well, so I mean an increase in levels of gene amplification in the genome, increase in double strand breaks, in aneuploidy, in the kinds of things that seem to go wrong in a global way with chromatin. And so there's a lot of papers out there, but there's very little in the way of direct connection. And what I say is controversial is a lot of people think that the genomic instability is a really secondary or tertiary product of what MYC is doing to cause a tumor. Right? So let me give you some examples of the kinds of horrible things that happen to MYC. So here's the c-MYC locus, and there's actually three MYC genes. I'll come to that in a minute. So here's the gene that I described. Rather simple genetic structure. This sort of regulatory region here where the promoters are, this is non-coding, and then you get an AUG in the second exon, and this white area is the open reading frame that terminates in the third exon. And you get splicing to get the final RNA. And as far as I know, there's not much regulation of this splicing. You don't see weird splice products or truncated proteins or anything like that. At least I don't believe they've been reported. So this is the normal locus expressed at low level in all proliferating cells that I've just been describing. And horrible things happen to this locus. So I intimated in the beginning that we first found MYC because of retroviruses have sort of picked up the gene, and that's allowed these retroviruses to become tumorigenic and transforming. And what they pick up, for the most part, is just this coding region, exons 2 and 3, and not the regulatory region. And so there's at least four different, and actually there's more, different retroviruses that have been isolated from tumors and animals over the years that have picked up MYC. And they now express MYC under control of their very strong promoter. So MYC is now really being socked into these cells. In addition, there are retroviruses and other viruses as well, I think hepatitis virus, which are hepatitis virus, that actually integrate into the MYC gene, most often between exons 1 and 2, but also sometimes upstream and downstream of the gene. And they have an enhancer effect that also winds up disrupting normal MYC regulation, and so that MYC is overexpressed and can't be turned off. And this is associated with leukemias and lymphomas in a number of animals, in rodents and in cats and in mice.
Why would the virus want to?
I'm not sure it does want to, actually. I think it's random. I think these are random integrations, and we see them because we see the tumors, and we pull out the tumors and we analyze them.
So does it help somehow in infection?
So if in this case, for example, where it picks up the gene?
Right, so does it help somehow virus to infect cell?
I'm not convinced it does. I mean, you could argue about this. So picking up this gene actually makes the virus effective, because it replaces an important protein component in the virus. The virus becomes effective and it becomes dependent on helper viruses. And then one of the things that happens is that these viruses start to spread and you get outbreaks of, they were first found because there were outbreaks of leukemias in chickens, and that's how the virus is found, but eventually the chickens die and that's the end of it. I think that these viruses sort of violate the kind of latency principle that makes a virus a good virus, doesn't really stay in the population. These viruses wind up killing your hosts. I suspect, we could argue about this, but I suspect that this is a random event, again, and we only see it because of the fact that there are virologists around who say, oh, there are sick chickens, let's isolate the viruses and see what they have. I don't think they usually persist in nature. Another thing that happens to MYC is that the gene becomes amplified, sometimes up to 150-fold. And that's observed in neuroblastomas and neural tumors, and also in lung cancer. It's also been observed in breast cancer as well. And so here, you still have the regulatory region of the gene, but it's clearly very much deregulated. You have many copies. And many of those copies are actually transcribed, so the levels of the protein can increase enormously. And finally, probably the most famous rearrangement of all occurs in Burkitt's lymphomas, and also in plasma, which is in humans, endemic in parts of Africa, and in plasmacytomas in mice, where the MYC gene, which is on human chromosome 8, translocates, breaks and translocates to an immunoglobulin locus you're on chromosome 14. And just like the case for the virus, it comes under control of the immunoglobulin enhancer and promoter and is expressed at very high level. So these translocations are hallmarks of these kinds of lymphomas. So there's a lot of complicated changes that occur, but I think the underlying thread is that all of them separate MYC from its normal physiological regulation. And so the protein is overexpressed and can't be turned off.
So why is it so tissue-specific? Why would not MYC amplification show up as tumors in other parts of the body? Is there any understanding of that? Or actually in those tissues there is an amplification process?
Well, certainly in the B cells where the lymphomas occur, this is a region that's highly expressed, and of course there are rearrangements going on for immunoglobulin genes. So MYC is actually becoming part of that. For this situation, it's a really good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. I suspect it's something about the history of these cells and the way these tumors develop. Usually, in many cells, overexpression of MYC actually leads to cell death. I think that cells have developed a very sensitive way to get rid of themselves when they overexpress MYC. And it may be that in these cases where there's amplification, these cells have learned how to avoid that effect, and maybe other cell types with amplifications have not. It may have something to do with the regulation, but I'm not sure. It's a good question. But, you know, it's possible that there have been amplifications in other tissues that people haven't looked at. Already one finds it in neuroblastomas, in lung, and in breast, and I can't remember, there are other tissues that have MYC amplifications. So that's already fairly, not that restricted, really.
Overexpression without amplification in some tumors as well.
Yes, that's right. You can see overexpression without obvious chromosomal changes, and I think that's likely due to things that are invisible to us that are involved in the regulation. Many breast tumors, for example, it's not quite clear why MYC is overexpressed. And it may be true also in these neuroblastomas where they find high levels of MYC without amplification. Right. So that's the sort of reason why I think MYC has been interesting to a lot of people, and there are a lot of labs that have been studying it, trying to understand what it does. And our goal has been to try to figure out what the protein is doing. Right. And MYC, so here's the gene again, and this is the protein that's coded by this open reading frame, it's got 430 amino acids. And it is a member of a larger class of proteins that are known as basic helix loop helix zipper proteins, all of which are transcription factors. And MYC is rather unique. It contains the basic HLH zipper at its very C-terminal region. And this is a region which is a protein-protein interaction domain and a DNA binding domain. And so you need two of these regions to actually interact with DNA. The helix loop helix zipper forms an interaction surface for another HLH protein, and then the basic region of the partner binds DNA. MYC also contains, so this was a giveaway that MYC was likely to be involved in transcription, although it actually turned out to take a long time to prove that. MYC contains other interesting regions, some very highly conserved regions, including one that's involved in transcriptional activation, which is involved in recruiting coactivator complexes, and then another region which is involved in the degradation of MYC, the very rapid degradation of MYC. I mentioned it has a very short half-life, and there's a phosphorylation signal that's very conserved in this region that's involved in that turnover. And if there's time later, you can ask me about that, and I'll tell you how that works. But so there are regions in MYC that make it look like a transcription factor. And actually, mutations in these regions often ablate MYC biological activities. So if MYC was a transcription factor that interacted with using that basic HLH zipper domain, we thought it was a simple problem for MYC to just homodimerize or heterodimerize with another protein of this class, and then it would bind DNA, because by itself, as a monomer, it didn't seem to. The problem was that we could never find any homo or heterodimerization of MYC, and it got very frustrating. But eventually we looked we actually went fishing for a partner by just taking this region and using it to screen a library of proteins. And what we came up with a while back was a novel protein, which we called MAX. And MAX is a small protein. It's only about 130 amino acids. And it's also a basic HLH superprotein. And so although there are lots of other basic HLH superproteins out there, they don't interact with MYC, but MAX very tightly forms the heterodimer with MYC. And this complex is able to bind DNA, and it recognizes the sequence CACGTG, which is an EBOX, so-called EBOX sequence. And the structure of this is actually a MAX homodimer. MAX itself does homodimerize, but the MYC-MAX heterodimer has now been solved as well in Steve Burley's lab, and looks very, very similar. So this is just the basic HLH region, and this shows you what the dimer looks like. So this is the helix. Well, let me start at this end. So this is the basic region, which forms an induced fit helix when it interacts with DNA. And when it dimerizes, it straddles the DNA, binding a major groove. So this is binding CAC, and this is binding GTG, the palindromic sequence. This basic region basically segues into another helix. Then you see a loop that comes around, and then it goes up into the second helix in the so-called leucine zipper. It's really a four-helix bundle. And these two structures, this very satisfying-looking structure. And this is really the interaction surface and what the DNA binding structure of this protein looks like.
Which of these sort of dimerization energies are stronger?
I'm sorry?
Which have better binding things? Is it the heterodimer?
Yes, the heterodimer. Yeah.
And you have said that MYC-MYC doesn't form.
It forms homodimers. They're almost undetectable. It's very, very, they're extremely weak. Right. MAX does form homodimers, and you can actually get them to homodimerize in solution, but they're very, very weak. And if you titrate in MYC, MAX much prefers to form this very tight dimer with MYC. Interestingly enough, in the cell, it looks like that MAX homodimers do exist, but they're phosphorylated. And the phosphorylation of those homodimers keeps them from binding DNA. So the homodimers can bind DNA, and they recognize that same sequence, CACGTG, but when they're phosphorylated, they can't do that. But the phosphorylated heterodimer is fine with binding DNA. So it seems like the cell has evolved a method to keep MAX homodimers off of DNA. What it really wants is for this thing to bind.
The circulation sequence seems very short.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Where does the specificity come from?
Well, that's what really the rest of the talk is about. I'm not sure I will answer it in an effective way, but I'm going to try to come to an answer for it. So CACGTG is a very common sequence. We first found that sequence in the collaboration with Hal Weintraub's lab by just screening for random oligonucleotides that would bind and doing a series of amplification selections and amplifications. We came up with that sequence. Now, many years later, it's fairly clear that it also recognizes that sequence in vivo. So you can do chromatin immunoprecipitation and you can find MYC on those sequences. That's fairly well established. There's also binding to sort of non-canonical EBOX sequences. And the binding is somewhat weaker, but one can also find association with those sites in vivo. So let me say something about that. The CACGTG, you find about once every 4 kb in DNA, and probably enriched in CPG islands in areas that are there. Many transcription factors bind this sequence. So there's MYC and MAX, and I'll tell you about other proteins in this family, MAD and MAX, that also bind. But there are also different proteins, such as USF and TFE3, and the microthalmia proteins, which also bind this. So this is a sequence which a lot of proteins like to interact. And certainly in the early days when we asked the question that you did, we assumed that there was more to it. Right, that there would be other proteins that would stabilize some interactions or other flanking sequences that were important, although they weren't easy to discern. I'll bet I will come back to that idea. So let me tell you a little bit about the dynamics of the complex formation, because I think it's important for a way to think about this. So when we look at cells that are in a resting state, and this could be fibroblasts, lymphoid cells, any cell, you name it, MYC levels are very, very low. RNA and protein is really almost undetectable, but MAX is there. Okay. you can find quite a lot of MAX in the cell. And in fact, it doesn't, the cell doesn't seem to change too much. And MAX is a very long half-life. It's, we've never actually been able to measure turnover of MAX. It's like a structural protein, almost like actin or something like that. It really just sort of accumulates in cells as cells grow. And so MAX probably exists in these homodimers. And it sort of sits around waiting for something to happen. And then when you stimulate cells to enter the cycle, what happens is that NIC levels rapidly increase. They go up, and then they go down. And then they remain constant as long as cells are proliferating. And that constant level is actually very interesting. It looks like a flat line, but in fact, it's maintained by this equilibrium between synthesis and degradation. So the cell is always working to maintain NIC levels. And when you do something like withdraw growth factors or induce differentiation, NIC levels go down very rapidly. MAX doesn't change. So the way we think about it is that when you induce cells, NIC comes along. It's got this rather short half-life. But when it comes along, it forms this heterocomplex with MAX, and then this binds DNA. And if you do simple experiments with binding sites in front of synthetic reporter genes, what you see is activation by MYC. And that, I think, is generally true, but MYC has lots of activities. But at least in this simple model, a binding site near a promoter will give you transcriptional activation. I think this is the main function of MYC, but there is more to it. So this is a dynamic process, then, because it's always depending on MYC synthesis and degradation. And it's one way to think about the tumor situations where MYC is overexpressed is that now you can't turn this off. It's a switch that's locked in the on position. There's no way to really regulate this. And so it continues.
So what you said was that if you take a promoter from a known MYC regulated gene and put it on the reporter gene, it's going to get it.
Yeah.
Not that if you put the sequence into some other promoter, it's going to.
Well, that happens too, but then it all depends what other proteins are involved in those complexes. Actually, the very first experiments were just done by taking an e-box, just multimerizing it, and sticking it in front of a stripped-down promoter, and just asking what happened, and make that
decision.
You can't take one. The effect is very weak. The effect is very weak. And in fact, MYC is a terrible transcriptional activator compared to lots of transcription factors. MYC activity is very low. Okay, you see 3 or 4-fold activation, where if you look at MyOD, you'll see 20 or 30-fold activation. So that's been a strange thing and an unsettling thing.
Is it sort of generally true that you see clusters in most of the known MYC regulated promoters?
Yes, that you often do see clusters.
Then is this the solution of the? Or maybe you are supposed to tell us the solution on this.
I will come to that. I'm not sure it's the solution, but there are places where you don't see clusters. And actually, there are places where you'll see several binding sites, and by chip, you'll only see one seems to be occupied, at least in some activating.
But one more question is that there's some people who did genome-wide chromatin immunoprecipitation on MYC, but one thing. Mm-hmm. And some of them, I thought Kevin Struhl and someone else.
They found a huge number of
sites, and some people said that maybe, you know, the epichips for chromatin immunoprecipitation is terrible, but I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, I'm going to tell you about that. That's where the talk's heading. We're one of the people who've done that kind of experiment, actually not in a different way. Okay. So one of the things that we thought about in the days when we were doing these experiments a few years ago was that it was interesting that MAX seemed to be around even when MYC wasn't around in the resting cells, and after differentiation, the levels didn't seem to change. But yet it didn't seem to bind DNA, and it formed these weak homodimers. It looked like it was transcriptionally inert. We didn't think it was doing anything by itself. And so we actually set out to look for other proteins that might interact with MAX. And so Don Ehrer, postdoc in the lab, basically used MAX to go fishing, just the way we use MYC to go fishing to find MAX. And he found a whole family of proteins, which we've, very unfortunately, I think, called MAD proteins, for MAX dimerizers, but it actually turned out, and we like the idea of MAD MAX complexes. It was a very stupid name, and it's got us through a lot of trouble, because there are other genes named MAD as well. So someday, my theory is that long after we're all dead, they're going to take all our cute names and give them numbers or something, and feed them into a computer. But anyway, we call, for the duration of the talk, we'll call these proteins MAD proteins. And MAD proteins are, in some ways, a lot like MYC. So they're basic HLA zipper proteins. They don't homodimerize. They don't bind DNA by themselves. And when they're induced, which is, in the case of the first one we found, during terminal differentiation at the time when MYC is normally going off, when these proteins are induced, MAD comes along and forms heterocomplexes with MAX in much the same way. And MAD also is very rapidly turning over protein. And the MAD-MAX complex binds the same EBOX binding site, CACGTG, as MYC-MAX. And I can tell you now that many experiments have shown that these really can occupy the same binding sites in vivo as well. The thing that's amazing and interesting about this is that MAD-MAX represses transcription. So whereas MYC-MAX activates, MAD-MAX represses transcription. And so one can argue if what MYC is doing at the sort of simple level is turning on lots of genes or genes that are involved in proliferation, then what MAD-MAX seems to be doing is perhaps turning those same genes off. And that would make sense if this were true, that the MAD proteins seem to be expressed at a time when MYC is being turned off and cells are terminally differentiating. So MAD might be an antagonist of MYC function, and pretty much everything we know suggests that. One of the things that have come out of this is a study that my lab and others have done trying to understand the sort of basis behind the transcriptional activities of these guys. And so this is this sort of antagonistic model that emerges. And we know that the way MAD represses is by recruitment of a huge molecule called SYN3, which is much more highly conserved than MAD itself. SYN3 exists in yeast. But MAD-MAX and MYC don't, for example. So this is a huge sort of platform called the co-repressor, which recruits many, many other complexes, the most famous of which is a histone deacetylase. And that is an enzyme which deacetylates histones. And I'll come back to what we think its role is in a minute. Certainly consistent with the idea that MYC is a repressor, because deacetylation of histones is associated with gene repression. And MYC, on the other hand, recruits a coactivator complex that's known as TRAP or TRAP, which itself then recruits histone acetyltransferases, such as GCN5 and TIP60. So these have the opposite activity as the histone deacetylases. And the TRAP complex can also bind chromatin remodeling factors, and MYC itself in other regions also binds other complexes. So what these guys are doing is really recruiting in higher order complexes that are presumably modifying the structure of chromatin in which the DNA is packaged. Just for completeness's sake, MYC also can act in repression, and it seems to do that by sequestering or inactivating another activator that's known as MIS-1. So there's yet another pathway for MYC function that's involved in repression, and it actually may be rather important as well. So I tend to focus on the activation and repression aspects of this, but you have to bear in mind these are complex proteins and they have multiple functions. So simply put then, the way we imagined things a few years ago was that there are a few target genes for these guys. They bind to the target genes as MYC-MAX complex, recruit histone acetyltransferase, acetylate histones in the vicinity of the promoter, and you get gene activation. And maybe MYC is weak, but then there may be other activators that come in and then cause these genes to be expressed.
You said that MAD and MYC are like reciprocally expressed. Is that always the case?
No. So it's more complicated than that. Okay. I wish it were so, but it's not that simple, and I think there's important issues there. I'll summarize that in a second, okay? Then one imagines during differentiation when MYC is normally turned off, MAD levels increase, the MAD1 protein. MAD binds to the same site, replaces MYC, and in fact, they're beautiful, I must say myself, beautiful data showing a switch between MYC-MAX and MAD complexes. And the MAD-MAX complexes, you can just follow it during differentiation. And so that occurs, and then MAD recruits this co-repressor with a histone deacetylase, which then deacetylates histone in the vicinity of the binding site, and that turns it off. Yeah.
So it seems that these MedMax and BigMax compete for the same site, right? So then one is shutting down chromatin. And so then how can the other one, I mean, you're saying that first the transcription vector comes to and recruits this chromatin modification complex as a co-compressor factor.
Yeah.
So how can that really work? I mean, what comes first? Is it really the transcription factor which somehow drills into the...
Yeah, who's first here?
Yeah.
Right. Who's first? What stage is this actually occurring? I'd like to think that this is happening at an early stage, so that perhaps in resting cells you have deacetylated histones. You bring in Nic, right? Nic comes in. Maybe this binding site is on the surface of a nucleosome or something, so that it's actually visible, or that there's a space between nucleosomes and it's actually visible. And so Nic can come in and actually acetylate. So that burst that occurs, remember I showed you Nic levels go up really high when cells enter the cell cycle. Perhaps what Nic is doing is sort of pushing acetylation of these regions. Right?
But you don't know if the binding site is going to sit inside acetylated regions itself?
Yes, well, it does. Yes, it does seem to, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
What is the range of the effect?
Well, so when people have looked at it's a really good question, when people have looked using chromatin immunoprecipitation around regions, this is a bit of a misrepresentation here. I mean, I've basically shown it happening
right
over here, but it really sort of happens within a few nucleosomes around the binding site. But not too many people have looked that far upstream or downstream. Mostly people have been satisfied when they saw a change around the binding site. And that's maybe a very important issue, I think, how far that spreads. So nothing is simple, and as Arnie's question intimated, there's really a lot of different activities and proteins that are really a part of this, what we call the MAX network, or maybe transcription factor module would be a better way to talk about it. So MAX is at the center of this little solar system of proteins. There's at least three MIC proteins, CMIC, NMIC, and LMIC, and there are some other genes which people argue about whether they're pseudogenes, which are related as well, in mammalian cells and invertebrates. So there's three MIC family members, and these are expressed in very complex patterns during development. Often they're restricted. They don't seem to be co-expressed, although it's hard to know. But there's clearly, in some cases, there's overlapping expression in certain tissues. In some cases, in development, some tissues will have NMIC and then switch to CMIC. And LMIC will come and go as well. So very complex patterns that really nobody's been able to make much sense of. These are very likely redundant genes in many senses. They all bind MAX. They all activate transcription to a greater or lesser extent. Then there's the MAD family of proteins. I described MAD1, which is induced during differentiation. But then there's MAD2, which is sometimes called MXI1, MAD3, and MAD4. All of these proteins are clearly paralogs of each other. They're all repressors. They all bind the SYN3 co-repressor, just as the MIC family binds the TRAP coactivator and the histone acetyltransferases. So they all recruit these complexes. And then there's a protein called MINT, which is kind of related to the MAD family, but yet in some ways different. And MINT stands for Max's Next Tango, actually. And we thought it was quite different from MAD, but actually it's also a repressor and also binds SYN3. And the expression patterns of these proteins are really complicated. Can people on the other side see this? So whereas MIC is off in G0 cells and then goes on when you enter the cell cycle and sort of stays constant and then goes off in differentiation, so that's MIC. And then MAX is sort of on all the time. And MAD1 protein goes up during differentiation. The MXI1 protein is on, seems like, all the time and then goes up during differentiation. Another one of the MAD proteins goes up in the S phase before differentiation and then goes down. And then the MINT protein is actually pretty much on it all the time, pretty much at the same levels as MYC, and kind of just stays constant. It seems to always be there. And all these proteins join CAC, GTG. So there's a lot of complexity in this system.
So you said that those MYC genes are all redundant, but between that, all the other ones also get amplified in the same way?
Yeah, yeah. So in fact, the NMYC gene was found because it was amplified in neuroblastomas, and it's on in many neuroblastomas.
Doesn't it make sense that if you knock the gene out in the mouse, the others take over, and now there's no phenotype that is knocked out?
No, there is a phenotype. They die. The only one that actually survives is the LMYC knockout. And actually, I have my doubts about that as well. But a long time ago, when the first people started first doing targeted deletions, they knocked out CMYC and NMYC, and you get quite early embryonic lethality. So
they're not redundant with the genetics.
So they can't. Right? They're not redundant. They may be functionally redundant in any given situation, but they don't take over for each other. Right? There is some evidence for compensation if you knock out CMYC and NMYC goes up a bit in some cells, but it's not enough to rescue the mouse. On the other hand, Fred Altsab has done a CMYC knock-in for NMYC. He's replaced NMYC with CMYC, and he seems to be able to rescue. Right? So the implication, it does rescue. I mean, shooting a hedge on it's actually a very clear result. It does rescue. But clearly, it can do the same thing. So I think these are doing the same things, but their patterns of expression are different. They're regulated differently. I think they evolved because they couldn't all do this thing that won't
be. And what's different? Is it mostly the promoter that's different, or is the
promoters are different. All the hallmarks of the proteins that I described, the basic HLH zipper, the ability to interact with MAX and TRAP and activate transcription, that's there. The conserved MYC box regions which bind these things is there. But then there's sequence changes throughout. There's genetic drift throughout the protein, and then nobody knows. Nobody knows what it really means.
So, but your sort of zero order hypothesis would be that if you would replace all three with one MYC protein, but regulated in such a way that its concentration is whatever the sum is of the three others now, that would be fine.
I believe so. Yeah, and I think the attempts in that direction have suggested that's going to be right. So we certainly spent a lot of time sorting through MYC genes, and I'll come back to some of the mammalian genetics toward the end, just because it's been a very useful tool for us to understand something about what MYC's doing. But this kind of complexity, which really boggled us, we tried to solve by going to an organism where things might be a bit simpler. And that turned out to be Drosophila. So after, I won't bore you with the story, but after many years of trying, we were finally able to identify MYC, MAX, and MAD orthologs in flies. And and the MYC gene, I think as you can see here, is very, very similar in its organization to the mammalian MYC. So it's got this non-coding regulatory first exon here, and then it's got the open reading frame here's in black, that spans exons 2 and 3 in very much the same way as the mammalian MYC genes are organized. So, over half a billion years of evolution, this general game plan seems to have been maintained. And we were also able, when we found MYC in Drosophila, we were also able to find a MAX homolog in Drosophila and homologs of MAD as well, which in flies we call MINT. I'll bounce back and forth between those names. And it turns out there's only one of each, so we don't find any gene families of these guys in flies. One of the very first things we found when we identified MYC in Drosophila was that it was this chromosomal localization, and the realization that chromosomal locus was the site of a mutation that had actually been identified in the 1930s, but the gene had never been cloned, and the mutation was called diminutive. And it turned out to be due to a transposable element insertion, actually right in the place where many retroviruses insert in the MYC gene, between that first and second exon. But the effect of this insertion was not to, this gypsy element, was actually not to overexpress MYC, but actually to underexpress MYC. So it's a hypomorphic mutant, and lower levels of MYC are expressed at various times and in various tissues. It's kind of complicated. And then we've also identified other mutations in MYC, one of which is a null, and which I'll talk about in a few minutes. And these are also hypomorphic mutations. These were P element insertions. All of the mutations give rise to viable flies. Females are sterile, but the flies are smaller. And that's where the diminutive, original diminutive phenotype came from. The flies are diminutive. They're smaller compared to wild type. And it all depends on how bad the mutation is. They can be smaller yet. But they actually are viable, and their organs are pretty much proportional throughout. They're smaller because their cells are smaller. So if you take these flies and pull cells out of a wing disc or a fat body or anything like that, and you size them using flow cytometry, where you're looking at forward scatter, which is a measure of cell size, a rough measure of cell size. There are actually better ones, but this will do. And you compare the size distribution in the wing disc in control cells versus this allelic series. So here's a one mutation with moderate levels of MYC, and here's another one with lower levels of MYC. What you see is that the cell size is smaller, and that's actually visibly true as well. So this suggested as a first approximation that MYC might be involved in the growth of cells and maintaining the size of cells. After a lot of trying, we were able to get a null mutation in MYC, and you also see a very dramatic effect on growth. So this is the larval stage of Drosophila. This is the stage where growth really occurs like crazy. So you go from here in a normal Drosophila over 4 days to this, and you have all these many, many cells in here are endoreplicating or getting huge. This is really going to be the food for the development of the adult fly. And of course, in here also are these imaginal discs, which are forming the adult organs, the eye and the wing and so on and so forth. If you don't have MYC, what you get, you can actually get to this stage, probably off of the maternal message that's present in the embryo. But at this stage, you don't really grow very much at all. In fact, this is a particularly egregious example of growth. Usually you just stay at this level and you die after a few days.
Is that also cell size or
yes.
Cell number?
It's both, actually. Cell number and cell size are way, way down.
So this never makes to the adults?
Never makes to the adults. Never. It never gets really gets past this early stage. Here's just a view of what that looks like. This is that very early larval stage. Here you see staining of cell nuclei in an organ that undergoes endoreduplication, where there's an immense amount of growth occurring. This is a control. This is the MYC mutant. The nuclei, which are stained white here, they're about the same size, just around this stage. But if you let a little bit of time go by, some other 24 hours go by, you see this large amount of growth in these cells, and the MYC cells really stay the same size. And another measure of that is that basically the endoreduplication that occurs in the DNA, the black is the MYC mutant, it goes nowhere, whereas the wild type control is endoreduplicating at a high rate. So MYC is really having, loss of MYC has a dramatic effect. And the opposite occurs. If you overexpress MYC, you get very big. So if you lose MYC, you don't grow. If you overexpress MYC, you really grow. This is clonal expression of MYC. Experiments we did with Bruce Edgar's lab with GFP labeled MYC in the fat body. And here you see these GFP positive cells. And these are the background cells, which have low or no GFP. So this is actually clonal expression. And I think you can see that these cells are huge. There's MYC expression in them compared to the background. They have more DNA. They're gigantic. Their nuclei are larger. So overexpression of MYC really makes these cells grow.
So the cell cycle is not affected much?
There is not much effect on the cell cycle. Actually, there's effect on cell cycle phases. Cell division time doesn't really change very much. The cell cycle phases get somewhat distorted. G1 becomes quite short, but G2M becomes quite long.
No net effect on proliferation.
So we did an experiment, which I don't show here. It was done a few years ago, which I think illustrates that idea pretty well. We overexpressed MYC in random clones in the wing disc and labeled it with GFP and just let those cells grow. and then we measured the size of the clone, and what the, essentially the time it took for the mass of the cells to divide, and then the time it took for the cells to divide. So we're measuring division time and mass doubling time, basically. And what we found was that with the MYC cells, the cells that were overexpressing MYC, so this is wild type, cells that were overexpressing MYC, what we had was huge clones, but they had the same number of cells. So what was happening was that the time it took for them to double their mass, to increase their mass, had gone down, while the division time was unchanged. So you got the same number of cells, but they were bigger and fatter cells. When you looked at their cell cycle, what you found was that G1 was short, and G2M had increased in length. So the cell cycle was the same size, but it was distorted, the same overall time, but it was distorted. If we cut this down by putting in string, which is an enzyme which accelerates G2M, what we found was that these big fat cells now got turned into cells of the normal size, but there were many more of them. So a kind of sort of subjective view of this, from the way I sort of thought about it, was that what MYC is doing is making the fuel, the stuff, you know, the goodies that the, that makes these cells big, and whether the cells become bigger or whether that stuff gets turned into more cells is controlled by another at another place. So that this kind of experiment suggested that what MYC was predominantly doing was pushing cell growth, and that cell division was controlled somewhat separately.
But I hope there was a checkpoint on the sides, which so somehow the way MYC encourages growth is by lifting that checkpoint.
Yeah, I don't know where that checkpoint is, actually, and I don't know if these cells go beyond a certain size, whether they just die or what, or how far we can actually push them. This kind of thing says that...
The ultimate size limit there, but the checkpoint, I thought that the cells, when they reach certain size, divide. Right? Mm-hmm. So they cannot divide before they reach
yes.
size.
Yes.
But I guess they don't have to divide once they reach that size.
That's all set by CBC25C.
That's what the thing we often use.
CBC25C, right. That's like the we use in...
That's right.
So right? Kind of the world goes to the same. They're measuring some amount and then pushing division, getting you cyclin B, CDK2.
Right.
And that all happens depending on the level and activation of CDC25. So if that's... I presume what happened here is when it was low, it shoots up and then it finally reaches its level
right.
and divides a big cell. But if you now raise it, it divides earlier.
Right.
So that's why the G2N compresses.
Compresses and you get more cells.
So that suggests that the division time and the size are this way. But what division time is being regulated is CBC25C.
Right.
But they're this way, and you can have fat cells dividing and you can have thin cells dividing. It's
certainly in yeast it's quite
right.
I mean,
somehow MYC has to affect that the set point of.
Well, it's not affecting the CBC25C here because you get fat cells, and that's regulating division time or entry into the G2M period as you.
So if we keep the. The size checkpoint the same place, and now it's growing faster. Then the naive logic will say people will hit the checkpoint sooner and will divide sooner, but this is not happening.
Correct.
And now it's moving the checkpoint.
Well, you could say it's moving the checkpoint, and the checkpoint the checkpoint is the concentration of CDC25C.
But it's not affecting the MYC.
What is
the
time?
It's not a size checkpoint. It is a level of
So can you
say that it's not the size checkpoint? But
yeah.
But that's not what.
But that concentration.
you're just looking at the size checkpoint.
But if you slow down with starvation or something,
if it's just not regulated by NIC, that's all. You make the assumption it's regulated by NIC. If it's regulated by something else,
but does someone,
its level will depend upon the something else, not NIC.
But does temperature dependence to include nutrient dependence? How does that come in? It's just common.
But
so if you can change the levels of CDC 25, will you compensate MIC phenotype in terms of cell size? Probably not.
You have an impact at some point because these wee mutants in yeast caused division of small cells. That's why they were called wee. And that's a serious overexpression of CDC 25 without a MIC-like function giving rise to size. So I think all of the organisms say these two things are not linked, and that's what can give rise to larger size. Normally, you see cells dividing as a function of mass, but you can dislink them, obviously.
That's what's happened here. And in yeast, of course, that's been known for a very long time. You can separate division from size.
But I think even in yeast, do we really know what was the signal that was converted into CDC 25, active CDC 25 level, really? I mean, what is it really regulating? Right? That is the effector in some sense. Mm-hmm. But what is it listening to?
It's regulating cyclin B because it's a phosphatase taking cyclin, the phosphate.
Right. No, it's regulating cyclin B. What is it what is the input to it? Right? Mm-hmm.
What's the input? What's upstream of it?
Right.
Exactly. There's probably a lot of
what is it looking out for?
I think there's a lot of things that are upstream of it, and I don't really know. Actually, I'm not sure anybody does.
Somehow, all those things are unaffected by the overexpression of meat.
That's correct.
Right?
One thing that clearly is regulating it is you don't want to enter G2M before DNA synthesis stops. Right. So that something carries you through S phase. That's the G2 border.
Right.
Right. Something carries you through S phase that prevents you from prematurely condensing. Premature condensation is a bad thing. So that's one thing regulating it.
Right. There's something like size or ribosome amount or something is being monitored, but what is it exactly? It may be a combination of things. It's a complicated decision.
I think it is. It is complicated. And I'm not really aware of size checkpoints in mammalian cells, for example. I think they exist.
Which has been done in three organisms, essentially. Yeah. I mean, is an experiment that says you can dislink size from the G2M entry
point. It certainly says that there isn't. Size checkpoints, at least that's the simplest explanation for this. And evidence for elsewhere for size checkpoint, that it's not a necessary assumption anymore.
What happened to fat cells that aren't dividing? Those seem to go in the face of they're not being, somebody's ignoring it. Maybe there's a checkpoint, but it's being overridden in that.
It's either overridden or it isn't there. Right? I mean, that's.
Right. So how do the mutations fit in? Is that completely uncoupled from the growth control? Or
I think the growth is actually driving the endoreduplication.
Okay, but you can have growth without endoreduplication. You can get a big cell.
Oh, yes. So in this experiment, for example, these are mitotic cells, not endoreduplicating cells. There's no, and we don't see endoreduplication in those cells. It's not like NIC drives endoreduplication.
You get cells as big without endoreduplication, or does that limit the
somehow endoreduplication allows the cells to get bigger. Yeah. So we never see cells as big as these guys that I just showed you. Mitotic cells never get this large.
Can you do a little bit of an analysis of what big means?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question.
I mean, does it mean more ribosomes? Does it mean a higher rate of protein synthesis? Does it mean, what is big mean?
I think it has primarily to do with protein synthesis. And I think it has a lot to do with coordinating ribosome biogenesis. And I think I'm going to show you, well, I don't know how much I'm going to show you this. But let me just point, before I get into that, let me just point out another thing about this. So the MAD protein, so this is MIC expression, as I just showed you, in one of those endoreplicating cells, which gives you this big, these huge cells. This is expression of the MAD MIC antagonist with GFP. And what we see here are smaller cells and smaller nuclei. So there's, you can see with DAPI staining, these are the neighboring cells that don't have it. There you go. And these are the MAD expressing cells. They're really sort of shrunken and smaller. So this idea of antagonistic effects that we try to argue occur on the transcriptional level seem to sort of carry through into this growth effect. And to get to Arnie's question, one of the things that that's very dramatic about these cells is that here's a group of MYC overexpressing cells, and if you stain with an antibody against a nuclear protein where ribosomal RNA transcription is occurring, you get huge amounts of this protein compared to the non-MYC expressing cells, and huge nucleoli as well. The cells that are overexpressing MYC have huge nucleoli. And this relates to something that I'll just touch on, and I can tell you more about it if you like, that we found recently that MYC directly affects ribosomal RNA transcription in both Drosophila and in mammalian cells.
Directly or indirectly?
Directly. So,
a couple of papers that say it transcribes the transcription factor for the ribosome.
So there's a lot of things that go into ribosomal RNA transcription. So there's a paper that one of these is a protein called UBF,
right.
And it's kind of a histone for ribosomal DNA. So MYC stimulates UBF synthesis, and there's a paper that reports that. But we've actually gone a lot further than that and shown that MYC only, yes, it does stimulate UBF, but it actually is directly in the nucleolus and binds to the polymerase 1 complex. We can chip MYC right on ribosomal genes in the termination and promoter region. And when we turn MYC on, it correlates with deacetylation of that region and recruitment of POL1 machinery. So it's a very direct effect. Now, there is a fly in that ointment, and that is that when you do the same experiment in Drosophila, you also see a very strong effect of MYC on ribosomal RNA transcription. But we have not been able to detect MYC in the nucleolus and on the ribosomal DNA in Drosophila. And that's something we're wrestling with now. Right? Those two papers are about to come out.
Does it have a ribosomal protein?
So MYC has a lot of targets, and it also appears to be involved in transcribing ribosomal proteins. Yes, a lot of ribosomal protein genes.
And there it is a direct target.
It looks like it is, yes. Looks
there
like
are CHCG ribosomal
proteins? Yeah, actually there are. Yeah, there are. In fact, when you look at ribosomal RNA gene in the nucleus, you find a huge cluster of CACGTGs on both ends of the gene, way above random distribution. It's really quite impressive. It's just covered with them. So there's a lot of binding sites.
Ribosomal proteins as well?
Yes, the ones that have been looked at, yeah. I can't say that it's been shown for every one of those.
Is it necessary? So if you elevate ribosomal RNA synthesis, don't you? That there are regulatory mechanisms that elevate ribosomal protein synthesis.
Well, MYC may be one of them. I don't know. Yeah.
There certainly aren't.
I mean, you would think there would be coordination between the ribosomal proteins and the ribosomal RNA. And we're going to really try to argue that MYC is one of the things that's doing that. There is a protein in yeast that Mike Tyers' lab has described, which does something that I think MYC might be doing, which is sort of connecting the rate of ribosomal RNA transcription to the cell cycle and the cell growth in general and coordinating those events. And maybe MYC is, that is MYC's function.
Is it B1?
Yes.
So just one question along the same line with what big means. Is it possible to look at surface receptors? So I guess the question is, when the cell gets larger, does the density of TKB receptor increase or
decrease?
So the question is, is the number of proteins fixed so that the cell gets larger, the density gets smaller, or is it the density that's fixed, or is it
I really don't know.
Is there some way
I think you could, if you actually were interested, you could really look and see whether that's true or not. We've never, looked at things like that. I mean, there clearly are other genes that are also induced as cells get larger, and presumably their, levels increase as well. But whether, if you look at a particular receptor and ask whether its density has changed, I don't know the answer to that.
I guess the reason I'm asking precisely, you know, there are different ways of getting cells water. Mm-hmm. Right?
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
Then the question is, the cells may be the same size, but they have to be different because the receptor density is different.
Yeah, but no, it's a good point. And I think that MYC is clearly one pathway involved in growth. There are many others. There's TOR, there's PI3 kinase, there's an insulin pathway clearly involved in growth and cell size in flies. And we've done some, using the system that with the endoreplicating cells, we've actually looked at MYC growth in other genetic backgrounds. So for example, mutations in the PI3 kinase pathway to see whether, it looks like they're not connected. Right, so MYC can still induce growth even in the absence of PI3 kinase signaling. However, if you mutate ribosomal proteins, for example, MYC is dead. So I think they're directed toward different pathways, different targets. And we're really coming around to thinking that MYC is maybe more involved in translation and making these ribosomal RNAs and ribosomal proteins and other things as well. Those are pretty crude experiments, and those kind of things we're going to look more at in the future. But I think that these growth pathways are not that interlinked. MYC's effect is primarily on, you see large nucleoli and large nuclei. You also see larger cytoplasm. But if you do the same, if you overexpress the PI3 kinase pathway, it looks like the cytoplasm is much larger than the nucleus. So I think these experiments are telling us that they really are directed in different ways.
I asked this to Anil, but mTOR doesn't seem to have directly any impact on the MYC activity. It's a very independent part. That's how you almost...
Yeah, there's not much evidence that suggests that it does. Mm-hmm. Right. I wouldn't say they're completely independent. I just think it hasn't been investigated enough. There's really nothing out there that says that we have not looked.
Because in yeast, for example, mTOR and SFP1 seem to be very tightly coupled.
I think it would be a mistake to think that SFP1 is MYC, but it's the only yeast-like function that seems close to MYC. This is just to beat a dead horse. This says that you can see the same sort of thing in many mammalian cells. So, for example, this is B cells in which you'd expect MYC as a transgene, and you look throughout development, and basically you get the red as the MYC-expressing cells versus wild-type littermates. You basically see the cells are larger by forward scatter and other things, and MAD does just the opposite. So these are T cell progenitors, these are wild type T cells, and then these are T cells that are expressing MAD as a transgene, so they get smaller. So this general small-large effect, I think, seems to be fairly conserved.
Is MAD also a nucleolus?
Is
MAD also a nucleolus? You're saying?
We don't know. No, that's an obvious question, and we just haven't asked it yet. We've been so caught up with the MYC story.
Clearly, the cells that have amplified MYC, the rate of RNA, of ribosomal RNA synthesis, the rate of ribosomal protein is higher.
In
RNA and then protein or translation.
So if you look at, I'll just sort of answer that in a different way. So if you look at cells where MYC has been knocked down or knocked out, the rates of ribosomal RNA are much, much lower. They're 30% of wild type levels. The rate of translation is also way, way down. And MYC overexpression appears to drive that up. And so whether that's true in all MYC tumors, I don't know. I really have not looked. But generally, many tumor cells have huge nucleoli. MYC cells, even from the very beginning, when people looked at cells that were transformed by MYC and MYC tumors, that was one of the things that was noted. That the nucleoli are huge. And so my guess is that, we'll see that.
What's the cellular distribution of MAX? Is it through
It's the same as MYC. It's largely nucleoplasmic.
And the overexpression of MAX does what to all these?
Well, if you really overexpress MAX, it kind of is toxic. Cells get really sick. They don't.
But until then, there's not.
We haven't seen much effect of MAX. And, knockouts of MAX are extremely lethal in mice. They don't. They really go nowhere. They basically are pre-implantation death. So losing MAX is a very bad thing in mice. So just to sort of stress that growth, what we've been sort of loosely referring to as growth, is a very complex thing, and that it's going to depend on many, many pathways, some of which we've been talking about. Obviously, various metabolic pathways, this ribosome biogenesis, which is involved in translation, and energy metabolism as well. And that you can't divide, you need growth to divide. If you have mutants in yeast that don't divide, they will still grow. But if you have mutants in yeast that don't grow, they really won't divide. They're, you need growth for division. There have been a lot of studies, as you might imagine, trying to look at genes that are regulated by MYC, so microarray studies, expression microarray studies, and there have been many, many labs have looked at genes that are regulated by MYC. And what you come up with, whether you use microarray analysis, or quantitative proteomic studies, or I talked to you about Drosophila genetics, or knockouts of MYC, is that most of the genes are genes that can be construed as being involved in growth. And these are ribosomal proteins, all kinds of genes that are involved in ribosome biogenesis. We actually see an increase in POL3 transcription. We see an increase in translation, many metabolic enzymes. Basically, a lot of things that you would argue could be involved in cell growth appear to be affected. We also can find a small number of genes in mammalian cells that are involved in cell cycle. For example, MYC through MYS1 appears to inhibit the expression of cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitors. We don't see this in flies, but in mammalian cells we see this. So MYC could be doing two things. It could be pushing growth in mammalian cells and also promoting the cell cycle by inhibiting CDKIs. Right? So they would be doing these two things. Now, this is actually, this list of genes here is huge. I mean, literally numbers in the thousands. And my first response to this, we did these experiments and others as well, is that these are not direct targets of MYC. It's impossible. You know, MYC is a specific transcription factor. All of these genes can't be regulated by MYC. They're probably secondary or tertiary targets. MYC, you know, make cells enter the cell cycle and do all these things, and that this is really a response to that. This is not really what MYC is doing. And so we set out to try to find out where MYC was binding.
Well, it's so surprising,
I think, because it's really a psychological issue, to be honest. I think what we wanted to believe, I think everybody who has a transcription factor likes to believe it's specific, right? There's not a lot of MYC protein in the cell. We believed, you know, that there really had to be a couple of target genes, a very small number of genes that were targets, and then everything would flow from that. So this was my view of growth. It may not necessarily be completely logical or rational. What?
It could be specific, but play chocolate.
Specifically, yeah.
Recognize certain places of DNA, but it can recognize, like, it can have many bindings.
Right, so you could say many of the binding sites are not relevant, right? That it just sort of sits on binding sites but doesn't do anything, right? So there may be non-functional binding sites and there may be functional binding sites. I actually didn't think there was enough MYC to go around in the cell to occupy all CACGTGs, and the feeling was that there had to be some real specific sites. And
there's more CACGTGs in the genome than there are copies of MYC.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, but it depends whether MYC goes on and off DNA and maybe cycles through more than one site. So this was sort of the idea that there were a small number of targets, and then that there were downstream genes, and then eventually you got lots of genes. Some of those targets might be transcription factors, and then you get other genes activated, and there would be feedback pathways, and eventually you would induce lots of genes that were seen in these microarray studies, and they would be involved in the growth effects that we saw. So this was the view that we had a couple of years ago of the way this operated. And it was sort of subverted to a certain extent by the fact that none of the target genes for MYC that came up in any of the microarrays or other studies appeared to be transcription factors, in fact. So it was a little worrisome that maybe this idea of a small number of target genes was wrong. And so,
could these genes, the target genes, have any tendency of clustering on the cell?
Not really, no. No, although I'm going to show you what the binding sites look like on the chromosomes in a minute. So around this time, we got interested in a method that was developed in Steve Hennekoff's lab at our institute, at the Hutchinson Center, to be bus uncensored. There's a postdoc in Steve's lab, now back in Holland, had the idea of trying to find binding sites for transcription factors by using a methylating enzyme to mark DNA in the vicinity of the binding sites. There's a method that's called DAM-ID. The postdocs call it DAM-IT. And the idea, as we carried it out, that basically Boss and Steve did a kind of proof of principle, a lot of proof of principle experiments. And so we tried to apply it to MICMACs and MAD, and I'll just run through what we did. So we took the Drosophila MICMACs and MAD proteins and fused them to the bacterial DAM methylase. The bacterial DAM methylase methylates adenosine in the very ubiquitous sequence GATC. So there's a lot of potential sites for methylation. When you take your protein and fuse it to the DAM methylase and it binds its site on DNA, the idea is that it will sort of bend over and methylate GATCs that are in the vicinity of the binding site. Right? And they did a lot of studies showing that basically you could get methylation with at GATCs within about 2 kb of a binding site, and then it fell off very, very rapidly. The highest degree of methylation occurring rather close to the binding sites. They've done a lot of work on that. I won't go through that. One of the nice things about this is that there is no endogenous adenosine methylation in flies, or in mammals for that matter. So the mark that's put here is permanent, it's not removed, and it should be unique. Right? So it should be a way of identifying the regions of binding site, obviously not the exact binding site, but at least the regions of the binding site. And so Amir Oyan in the lab took MICMACs and MAD, put them into Drosophila cells, and these are the Drosophila homologs of these, linked to the DAM methylase, and expressed them at very low level in cells. So basically actually used a heat shock promoter, but in the absence of heat shock. And we're just kind of looking at leaky expression. We didn't want to flood the cells with these proteins. And so the way you do the experiment then is you, on one other very important thing that I didn't say, is that the methylated GATC can be cut by the enzyme DPN1, which doesn't recognize the unmethylated sequence. So you can isolate a fragment, right, that flanks a binding site, or two fragments, or fragments that contain two sites by cutting with DPN1 and getting small fragments. And so the way we did the experiment was we put MICMACs or MAD in cells. We did separate experiments. And one nice thing I think that distinguishes it from CHIP, I'm a big fan of CHIP assays, but at least you're not cross-linking DNA, you're not putting formaldehyde into cells. This is really occurring in live cells. You're binding your transcription factor, you get your methylation, you extract your genomic DNA, and you get your methylation, then you cut with DPN1, and you get small fragments. And we actually sized fragments that were a couple of hundred nucleotides, basically. So we were really looking at small fragments, and you separate them, you label them as Psi-5, and then as a control, you can either use DAM alone, or you could use MIC with a mutation in the basic region, for example, so it won't bind DNA, just to get a feeling for what the background is like. And then you isolate the methylated fragments from this, and separate those, label them as Psi-3, and then you use them, mix them together, and then you do the usual kind of array to look for binding. That's actually a painting by Paul Klee. I couldn't stand showing another array. So one of the nice things about this is that's actually a fairly easy experiment to do, right? Which means you can do, yeah, go on.
Is there reason to believe that the time scales at which this methylation occurs and transcription would actually occur are similar? So that, for instance, I mean, you wouldn't want the case where you had some transient binding that has no chance of starting transcription, but it's plenty fast enough to methylate and then falls off. You might be getting a bunch of false positives, or vice versa.
Yeah, we kind of worry about that sort of thing. If the protein were binding DNA, sort of scanning along, it would just sort of methylate all these sites. I think, you know, some of that may happen, but I think that, and in principle, it could be a big problem, but it doesn't seem to have been a problem. And I think a lot of that sort of random stuff just gets subtracted out, or it just gets lost in the noise, in the background noise. And there is noise, but I think doesn't appear to be statistically significant, at least with our proteins or with other proteins that people have looked at. We do see, and we've used several criteria to convince ourselves that the sites we're seeing are actually real sites within limits.
What is metal sensitive in when you sort the fragments, how do you identify?
BPN1.
Okay.
BPN1. So we only get fragments if you digest with BPN1, which recognizes the methylated A. So that's what's methyl sensitive. And then you just look at the ratio. So the way I'm going to show you the data, we've done a lot of experiments, and there's been statistics applied to this, and all the usual gory stuff, which but the data, the way I'm going to show you the data is like this. So the Drosophila genome has been sequenced, and so this would be a chromosomal region, large chromosomal region, so blown up here. And these vertical bars will represent genes. And the dots represent a binding site, or a binding region, perhaps better said, roughly defined by binding by MAD protein, by MAX, and by MYC. Okay? And we've done all sorts of combinations of these. The intensity of the color in each of these is related to the p-value for the binding site, as determined by many experiments, statistical analysis. The arrows represent genes which we found by expression array analysis are upregulated when they're pointing up, or downregulated by MYC alone. We haven't done the array analysis for MINT or MAD, but we're doing that now. But so the arrows that correspond to binding sites might suggest that these are genes that are actually regulated by the binding. So this is the way the data look on the four major Drosophila chromosomes: the X chromosome, the left and right arms of chromosome 2, and the left and right arms of chromosome 3 and little chromosome 4. And I think what you can appreciate right away is that there's a lot of binding sites. Right? We find many, many sites. And most of those sites actually correspond to genes that we see regulated by MYC and MAX.
Give me a number. Is it 100, 200?
Well, this is probably about 300 genes here, and we think it's a gross underestimate, because the way we've done this experiment is we've probed the cDNA array, right? So we're only looking at those that happen to overlap a coding sequence. And we have reason to believe now, for newer experiments, the number is much higher, and I'll actually show you some data.
Yes, okay. How big is the Drosophila genome?
In terms of number of genes?
No, just
number of nucleotides. So it's about 10, it's tenfold less complex than the human genome, right?
And do you have some, how many molecules are in a
Drosophila cell? Right, in this case, I don't really know the number. It's not huge.
It's not 1,000.
Right.
Would it be a lot smaller?
No, it's probably around the same the way we've done this experiment.
That seems like a reasonable number. Mm-hmm. 300 out of 15,000 genes. Mm-hmm. That's a very reasonable number.
Yeah, but I think it's an underestimate. And actually, what the newer data is saying, that it's more like 20% to 30%.
I don't understand your argument. Why was it an underestimate?
Well, I haven't actually made the argument. I'm just telling you that there is an argument. But let me go through it.
Okay.
Part of it. I did say something. You're right. But what I said was that the way the experiment was done would underestimate the number, because we only screened arrays that were the arrays that we had at the time that were cDNA arrays, right? So the only fragments that would score as positive would be fragments that happen to overlap a coding region, right? So promoter regions that were upstream of a coding region where the fragment happened not to fall into that cDNA, we'd miss all of those.
So the question is, do they recognize anything other than cDNAs? Do they make other things?
Yeah, well, they do. Right. They do.
So you're saying you're looking at binding regions that aren't in what we call regulatory regions at all? You didn't even include regulatory regions.
That's true. In the array, no regulatory regions were included. We were just looking at cDNAs.
So, but okay. So, if they bind CAC GPG, right? This is sig
basis,
mm-hmm.
right? So 4 to the 6 is 2 to the 12, mm-hmm. so 4,000.
Mm-hmm.
So then, in 10 to the 8 bases, you would get many, 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 many more than what you have here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I would say this is really a small number, right? Because if it can really bind in all those places, then you should find methylation in all those places. You basically find the whole genome there, because not the whole genome, but very, very large.
It's actually less because it's a deep gene, but still much. Other supplements,
there is some methylation in flies, but it's not regulating the way the mammalian cells.
Right, just
everything regulates
the gene. We're actually looking at smaller fragments than that. So we're looking at several hundred nucleotides.
Yeah, I agree with that. No. So, but this still indicates that there is something more that determines where this thing is going to go than CACGTG, because otherwise it would be plastered all over the place.
Well, I don't think, I guess my point is that we wouldn't, if it were plastered all over the place, we would not see it from this. From this assay.
Right. Did you just look at how many times this word, let's say, is a mid genome?
I mean, it's about one every 4 kb.
So it's what you expect, it's not more or less. Well,
the question is that, is it an artifact of the p-value setting, right, that subtracted this off? Or actually there is some physics like they are clustered together and they can remove nucleosomes that stops things from binding in those circumstances or not?
I don't know.
No, but this is important, right? And so you could, for instance, look at, do you get dots everywhere where there happens to be a more than one CACGTG close to another one? So maybe this is just enhanced binding of mix, right? So as you say, it may bind everywhere, but there is just variability, and because of this labeling that you do, you only pick the ones where there happen to be more.
That's possible. Yeah, that's possible. Let me continue with this, and we'll see. We'll see whether you agree or not. To me, this looked like an immense number of binding sites. That's like, as I told you, like the mindset that I had in the lab is that there are really only going to be a few genes that were bound.
So you keep on saying there isn't enough MYC to bind. What is the abundance? How many micromolars?
Who knows how much of a transcription factor is present in the cell. The numbers of, you know, that I gave you between 10,000 and 30,000.
Like the Western blots or something, can you figure out anything?
Those numbers were about somewhere between 10,000 and 30,000 molecules per cell in a proliferating fibroblast.
So that's not any possibility.
Bear in mind something I said in the beginning, which is that the half-life of the protein is very short.
How does it matter? Do you want to know that?
No, it does matter, because it's a question of whether this assay measures near transient binding. Right? So if it binds to a site and goes off that site, or binds to a site and turns over, the site will still be marked, right?
Yeah, but that depends on how long you wait it. Otherwise, every possible thing, someday, if you wait for 3 years, then everything will be marked.
No, we're not waiting 3 years.
Is everything marked?
What?
Is everything marked?
No, everything isn't marked.
There are
CACGTGs that are not marked.
To the extent that this methylation is permanent,
this is only coding.
What we see there is the integral over the activity. And then the big question is, if you incubate twice as long as you did, or half as long as you did, do you see the number?
Yeah, well, there's been some experiments that have been done, and we haven't seen where we incubated longer, and we haven't seen much difference. There are also certain things you incubate too long, the cells just eventually just crap out. But so you can't go too far. We haven't seen time as being a major effector on this. Regions of DNA that are generally considered to be heterochromatic, right, even though they have CACGTGs in them, we see very little, if any, binding. In many repeat sequences, we see very, very little binding. So I'm telling you a couple of things here. One is that we see, for me, a surprising amount of binding, widespread binding. Two is much of that binding seems to correspond to actual regions located near genes that are regulated by MYC. The binding appears to occur largely in euchromatic regions and not in heterochromatic regions. And lastly, the binding seems to correlate with the prevalence of CACGTGs. So a bioinformatics guy at Columbia named Herman Busmaker has developed an algorithm which he calls Reduce, where he just basically looked across the genome to try to ask whether there were sequences of 7 base pairs or less that correlated closely with the degree of binding that we found for these proteins. And what he came up with these p-values was CACGTG. sort of unbiased search for those sites.
That was the top motif.
Mm-hmm.
That was the top motif?
That was the top motif by a long shot.
Were he took regions just around your points?
No, he just basically, and don't ask me to explain this in too much detail, he basically just looked across the whole genome at the binding, right?
It's a cDNA, you mean?
The cDNAs, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how big was the cDNA space?
I don't know. Offhand, it's in the paper.
You're saying that he took all the cDNAs and found the most overrepresented
sequences that corresponded to the degree of binding.
It's a linear fit.
What do you mean?
Linear correlation between the amount of that sequence and the amount of expression, the amount of binding you get at that cDNA.
So to every cDNA, there's some
number, which is
how much binding there is on that. I'm trying to actually remember now whether he used the whole genome or not.
So there's a degree of binding.
It may not have been cDNA,
and he doesn't.
He must have used the whole genome.
That's the only way it would make sense. Yeah, not the cDNA.
Because you bind outside the gene, but you methylated the gene.
Right.
So he used the whole genome, and what he found was that there's a very good correlation between the presence of CACGTG and the methylation site within that vicinity.
Right.
So this was not from expression, it was from methylation.
Yeah, from methylation. Yeah, okay. Right, it's based on the methylation data.
So that's the correlation.
Yeah, that's the correlation. In addition, somebody was referring to this before, a number of labs have followed this idea up in mammalian cells, and so at least three labs have done chip-on-chip analysis from MYC binding sites, basically walking along certain chromosomal regions. The Affymetrix group has looked on human chromosomes 21 and 22 and come up with numbers very close to what we find, that something like 15 to 20% of genes that have 15 to 20% of genes seem to have MYC max occupying eBox binding sites. So
You mean in sequence or in actual, or
they're actually there. So it's chip. So they do immune precipitation with an anti-MYC antibody, and then they basically look at the fragments of DNA that come down and ask how they're distributed. And
but
one point four had to do with binding.
I found sites just all over the place and along the chromosome, not in the genes.
They did. But many e-boxes were occupied. But they also found sites in genes.
So something never made sense to me, and this was So he did what Mike was saying, and he looked literally across the entire chromosome, and he found just a ridiculous number of
25,000 binding sites.
Right. And he was finding more than the number of what we would consider the number of MYC molecules, which means that
we're about the same.
So it's hard to imagine that MYC is even capable of activating all of these guys.
It may only have to be there transiently to activate it.
But if that's the case, then there's a whole time scale issue that has to go into this equation. It's just not there at all.
No, but he's using a population of cells, right? So you've got cells that are in all different states. MYC is continually being made and turning over through these genes and occupying, in a population basis, all of these different sites. It's not one cell that's synchronized.
But it could very well be that in any given cell it could transiently occupy all these different sites, but that the real sites, for some reason, require the real sites that you get transcription from require some co-binding site that actually leaves this thing there long enough to create transcription. So just searching around the genome, it stops on all these sites, and you see, in this method, you see all these things light up, and whatever scroll did, you see all those things light up. But to actually get transcription, there's a time mechanism. You have to really stick on there.
Well, that may be, but we are seeing that many of these sites correspond to transcriptionally active regions.
So we can absolutely see those as well.
Yeah. I guess a more trivial bioinformatics question is that each transcriptional activation correlation or cluster is correlated with clustering of the sites or not. If it is, then there is at least a nice simple argument that you have everywhere things bound, but if you have multiplicity of binding, that might help regulations. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of easy to see if you want to check.
But maybe just for the question, but the activation that Nick does, do we know that it's anything more than just opening up the property? Or could it just...
That may be it. That may be the bottom line of this. We'll come around to it. This is another attempt to look at this. This is chromosomal staining with an antibody, polygene chromosomes with an antibody against Nick. And the red is the mixed staining, and the blue is DAPI staining, and it's largely, the strong DAPI staining is largely heterochromatic region, genes that are not expressed. And basically what we see is mixed staining in the interband regions, which largely correspond to euchromatic regions, basically throughout the chromosome.
And would you have resolution to say, every band has been taken?
Well, I mean, so looking at this, I'll show you actually a better resolution in a second. This just gives you sort of general view. This is when we just sort of first started doing this. Here's another transcription factor called HARI, which is also a basic HLH protein. And HARI binds to a lot of genes, but you don't see with many regions that Nick binds to that HARI doesn't. It has a very similar binding site, but it seems to be much more restricted.
It also has like a six-base binding site?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a basic HLH as well. There's some Schmitz here.
That's a good control from those
things. Here's mixed staining, anti-mixed staining in the green on a much better resolution. We're kind of getting better and better at this, although this you can't really pay too much attention to. And what you see is there's a lot of staining. I mean, it really is throughout. We also see this is staining with this phosphorylated C-terminal tail of RNA polymerase II, in the case genes that are actively being transcribed. There's certainly overlap between these and Nick, but we also see regions where we don't see a lot of active transcription where Nick binds as well. Okay. So again, we'd argue that, without trying to be too precise about it, that Nick binding is widespread. So I mentioned before that I didn't show you any data for this. This is rather new, but we believe that Nick is strongly involved in Pol I transcription, and we can find Nick on Pol I promoters, and we see if we turn Nick on or off, we can see effects on Pol I promoters. Earlier work that we've done has shown that Nick stimulates RNA Pol III transcription, and then I told you about Pol II genes. Which have come up from binding studies and from microarrays and from proteomics analysis, where Nick appears to also stimulate many genes that are involved in metabolism and translation. And so I guess I'd like to argue that widespread binding and these sorts of considerations suggest that Nick's effects are very broad in the cell. And it's controlling transcription in a rather, I hate to use the word global, but I'll use it anyway, in a rather global way, and that many of these correspond to cell growth. Now, while we were kind of pondering this, we got some information from what was actually a surprising source. One of the things we've been interested in the lab is the role of Nick in embryonic development. And I mentioned earlier that 10 or 12 years ago, people had knocked out Nick genes during embryonic development, and they got early embryonic lethality. Basically, you stop. You stop development at around day 8 to day 10, which is quite early, and so nothing happens. But we decided to revisit this issue and use methods of conditional targeted deletions where we could knock out Nick at a particular time in a particular tissue and really then look and see what was happening in those tissues during development. And there's an interesting story here, but I'm not going to talk much about the biology of this. Paul Knopfler, a postdoc in the lab, decided to knock out NNIC, one of the Nick family genes, in the brain, in the nervous system, where it's very highly expressed during development. And he got a rather dramatic effect. Basically, he got very small brains. In particular, we got a very large effect on the cerebellum, the region that is involved in coordination and movement. And so this is a wild-type brain, wild-type cerebellum, rather. And you see these are granular neurons in here, and you get these sort of folds, which are very characteristic of the cerebellum. And this is from a mouse in which NNIC was knocked out at around day 12 and a half. So, and this mouse actually survives, it's born, but it has very, very small cerebellum and a very small brain, but it still actually does just fine. It's got ataxia and tremors, and you really don't need a brain, I think. But there's this sort of residual remnant of the cerebellum here, and we've done a lot of studies on what's happening during development in these mice. So one of the things that we had...
The cells are
small? Well, the cells are small and there are far fewer cells. There are very few cells.
Less neuronal connections.
Yeah, there's less neurons. The granular neurons, but if you go back to around day 12 and a half to the rhombic lip where all the progenitors for these are, the rhombic lip is really small and the proliferative burst that occurs normally doesn't occur when NNIC is gone. Interestingly, if you look at that region in the normal brain, the progenitor of the cerebellum, and you do a immunohistochemistry with an NNIC antibody, you see this domain of NNIC expression. It's just burning in there. I think NNIC is just driving proliferation, this huge expansion of cells that occurs in this region of the brain early on. But it's another story. Paul looked hard at the cells in the brain. And one of the things he noticed was that they actually looked different. So this is an area called the ventricular zone, where cells are undergoing mitosis at the bottom here and differentiating into motor neurons at this stage. One daughter cell becomes a motor neuron and then goes flying off to somewhere else. And these cells are actually dividing as they move up and down through this space of the ventricular zone. And this is what sort of a healthy, normal one looks like. You get these big fat nuclei, the cells are large, they sort of move up and down. But in the NNIC null, the whole region was in fact smaller. You can't see that here, we've just taken a little slice of it. The whole region is really reduced in size. But we noticed that many of the cells really, the nuclei looked really different. They were very dense, very darkly staining, and the cells themselves were smaller. Everything was kind of reduced in this. And Paul was really taken by the fact that the nuclei were different. He almost never saw any mitotic cells at all, that the nuclei looked different. And he started to think about whether there might be, when you knock out NNIC in these cells, whether there might be more global changes in chromatin and in packing of DNA. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, DNA is highly compacted in the nucleus. You know, several meters are compacted into something the size of a nucleus. And that occurs by wrapping DNA around histones and then by higher order coiling and supercoiling of DNA. You get a very, very dense compaction. And those histones, as you know, are those nucleosomes actually represent a kind of a barrier to transcription. And one of the ways to overcome that barrier is by modifying histones. And one aspect of that are the N-terminal tails of histones H3 and H4, which are generally positively charged if they're not modified. And those histone tails are believed to form a sort of tighter complex with the phosphate backbone of DNA and sort of represent a barrier to binding by factors to a region. So a gene would be off if the histone tails are in contact with the DNA, the positively charged lysines.
My question is,
yeah.
In this case, the DAM assay, like you were showing us before, the stencil thing,
yeah.
So the mechanism, the DAM puts a methylates the A of this one sequence, does not depend on the state of the chromatin?
It probably does, actually. It probably does to a certain extent, yeah. In fact, DAM methylation has been used as a probe for a sort of chromatin structure to a large extent. So it could, yeah. That is one thing to worry about.
This is how complicated, I would think, the interpretation of these results.
Yeah, I think it does complicate them, yeah. Sure. I think it does.
Thank you.
asking if you're doing it all comparatively to a control.
But there is a control each time, and actually the control we use is usually the dam methylates alone.
You don't get that. In the heterochromatin, you don't get that.
Right.
So clearly, the state of chromatin, that's the most compact. Clearly, the state of chromatin will depend on binding and then methylation.
So you're saying, I'm sure you can't really tell if they can actually bind.
Nicholas is saying is that we don't know whether because the thing didn't bind or whether because the thing bound right just to tie it around it.
Right. I mean, so that is definitely a caveat to the interpretation I made about Greener.
Yeah.
Okay, so bear that in mind. On the other hand, if you actually look at mixed staining, and I may show you something like this later, I'm not sure. If you look at mixed staining in nuclei where you can clearly distinguish heterochromatic regions, you don't see it. And I showed you the polykine chromosomes where you don't see it. So.
But then you should see a difference between the effect of methylase on MAD, attached to MAD, and MIG.
Right.
Right? Because in one case, we're assuming that MAD still has inhibitory activity, right?
Yes, and we don't. We don't see. You see, there's very strong overlap between the MIC and MAD sites. That's one of the things that made us think we probably at least on the right track with this.
It doesn't really have something.
Maybe it doesn't. I mean, we don't really know the answer, but maybe it doesn't. I mean, the DNA is wrapped around the nucleosomes, right? So perhaps most of those sites are actually accessible for methylation.
It's not so simple because. Right, when you do an experiment, presumably you're in a mitotic state.
Mm-hmm.
So there's both MIC and MAD. You may be labeling only MAD, I mean, labeling whatever with your methylase, but we know that it's still MIC that is winning under those conditions.
Why do we know that? Sorry? We're only expressing the damn methylated protein, right?
And but you're constituting
the chromatin.
It's often
what controls,
sure,
what
yeah.
controls the state of the chromatin is not whether methylase is there or not, right? It's whether MIC is winning over MAD.
Yes.
Right? So there's no
in these cells there's really no endogenous MAD being expressed. Right. Or very, very little as far as we can tell.
Which is to say that MIC is winning.
MIC is winning. When we overexpress MIC, when we express MIC in these cells, MIC is winning.
So therefore, the chromatin is open,
mm-hmm.
and therefore, the methylase has access, even though it sits on a little bit of MAD.
Yeah, perhaps.
Like
I don't know whether the methyl. I mean,
the only question is.
I don't know whether the methylation precedes the actual, you know, import of the. Of the machinery, of the histone acetyltransferase machinery, and when that occurs, or you know, how that actually happens, the timing and the order of which these characters actually appear on the stage, I don't know. I would suspect that binding actually that the methylation, that the damn methylase that's fused occurs very, very rapidly upon binding.
But still, we would expect in the case of methylation and methylase attached to MAD,
yes.
we should expect an effect of MIC. So if there was some way of doing this experiment with more or less MIC, right?
Yeah. So put in MAD with the damn methylase.
Right.
And then vary the levels of MIC and see what happens.
Yeah,
okay,
what
very good. All right, we're on the same point. Those are actually experiments we are doing right now. We're looking at that right now.
But you had binding data for both MIC and MAD.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. Both overexpressed in those cells.
And
not a lot.
So in the MAD overexpressed
mm-hmm.
cell,
mm-hmm.
you would expect. Okay, so this is maybe just a repeat of what Borg was saying. In which case, I apologize.
That's
but
right.
then you would expect it to recruit. Because the acetylation of the histones and therefore more heterochromatin, and so you would expect an effect on how much methylation you see, right?
We don't see much effect, though, right? Over in this population, we still see essentially the same binding sites.
But that could be maybe because it's a relative thing. Maybe in total there is less methylation, but because it's competitive, you.
maybe the initial recruitment of the histone deacetylase, which you're arguing would obviate the methylation,
right,
occurs after the methylation has occurred. Maybe it occurs later. Maybe the initial deacetylation,
okay,
in fact, is not sufficient to induce heterochromatin. There might be a little bit of a confusion here between what constitutes heterochromatin and what histone deacetylases are doing.
Okay.
I think we're bumping into
Arnie, you promised me I could go on till 10 o'clock at night.
You're doing this with like 10 million cells, right?
Yeah.
So can you tell the difference between sites where you get methylation at one site in
more than 4 million,
9 million of them versus one where you get in 500,000 of them?
No, I mean, well, sure. I mean, it would be the representation of the fragment, right?
And you have that data, or was it irrelevant, or
what data?
You mean quantitative amount of hybridization to the different features on the chip?
No.
So in other words, some features would be at 1%, some at 100%.
Right. I mean, we certainly. We were very, very stringent about what we included as being a bound site, right? So as I said, you know, we kind of pulled in PBRs. A lot of things that were on the border we just threw out. So we looked at things that were like three standard deviations, right?
But I mean, do you know what percent of the 10 million cells had to be methylated to get included in your group?
Those numbers are almost certainly out there somewhere. I'm sure Steve and Voss had determined that, but I don't know them off the top of my head. Sorry, I don't actually know.
So the prediction would be that if you incubate longer with MYC, you would see more methylation, but not with MAC. Because with MAC, you have to methylate it before the chromatin comes.
Yeah. So I mean, what I was going to say is that deacetylating histones on DNA does not induce heterochromatin and block everything from binding. Right? There's a series of events that occur, right, including methylation. So you deacetylate, then you become a target for methylation, di or trimethylation, and then you get binding by HP1. And there are probably many other pathways to heterochromatin as well. So I'm not convinced that deacetylation is somehow shutting down chromatin so that this little damn methylase can't bind anymore. I don't think that's what happens. And in fact, now that I'm sort of starting to get the wheels turning, it's been a while since we published this, and I've thought about it that critically for a while, we've looked and found that actually if you overexpress a damn methylase, you can get lots of methylation in heterochromatic regions. So it's not an absolute barrier. So I'm not sure that we're just not seeing heterochromatin because it's impossible to methylate it with the damn methylase. I think that it is possible to methylate it. And the other thing I was going to say, never mind. So what are we doing? Are we going to throw them out?
We have a course.
What are the organizers looking for? A room.
Them to get another room for them. So you should just go on.
Okay.
Okay. I don't have that far to go. So. Yeah. N-mic staining in wild type and an N-mic null cells. The brown is the mixed stain. And so I think one of the things you see right away is this region is really truncated. It's not just that we cut the piece that way, but it's actually smaller. The cells are smaller, and you see these dense nuclei. If you look with, and there's no mixed staining, if you look with an antibody against acetylated H3, so this active chromatin mark, or acetylated H4, what you find is that you get lots of brown staining in the wild-type controls. But if you look at the MYC nulls, you can see a little bit there, but it's actually way, way down. So these are in tissue sections now from these grains, right, here and here. So it's as if the acetylation has decreased in these tissue sections. So we were kind of astounded by this, that there could be such a dramatic effect over the nuclei. And so we've done some more experiments, and one of those experiments has actually been to take brain cells, either cerebellar granular cells, out of these mice. And so they basically have a I think this is
it. Look good.
and so this actually provides a system where we can acutely snip Mick out of these cells. And so we take these cells, put them in culture, where they are in culture, and then we put in an enzyme which will actually remove Mick. And that enzyme is marked with GFP. So these cells with the white arrows are cells that we...
We stay here. Please.
Okay. So cells with the white arrows in these three fields are cells that have received the Cre and have lost NMIC. And we have staining to show that NMIC is actually gone or greatly reduced in these cells. Where neighboring cells, which are not green or very little green, we don't see loss of NMIC. And now if you look at this population of cells with an antibody against acetylated histone H3, what you see is that all the cells with the arrows that have lost NMIC also do not stain with H3. And as a control, we took the other family, MYC family gene, and cut that out with the Cre recombinase, and we see no effect of the acetylation. And that makes sense because c-MYC is not actually expressed in these cells at all. And this suggests that this loss of acetylation is not an artifact of the Cre or the recombination of removing MYC. That's actually the kind of MYC that you remove, and it's the one that's actually expressed in these cells. So I mentioned that if you deacetylate, that the next step to becoming silent is to methylate the histones. And so we use an antibody against lysine 9 on histone H3, an antibody that recognizes the dimethylated variant of K9. And so these are wild type cells, and there's very little staining with K9. There actually is staining. It's just hard to see there. It's a kind of a speckled light staining. But in the NMIC null cells, it looks very dramatic. We actually get an increase. And we've kind of done that now with the dimethyl form, which is high in the null and higher in the null than the control. And with the trimethylated form, also a mark of inactivation, again higher in the null cells than in the control. And with another antibody against trimethylated lysine 4 in H3, which is a mark of active chromatin, which is faint but on in the control, but it's off in the null. So we seem to be accumulating, when we get rid of MYC, we seem to be accumulating across nuclei at this sort of level, where we're looking at whole nuclei, we seem to be accumulating marks for inactive chromatin when we get rid of MYC. And so we asked whether we could reverse that. And so we took cells that are MYC null. We were staining with DAPI, and I think you can see that there's a lot, these are very intense DAPI staining in large islands. There's no MYC expressed, so this is stained with an anti-NMIC antibody compared to wild type. Acetylation is way down. Make it darker. And now we put NMIC back into these cells. And what we see, there are some cells that don't express it because the vector just didn't get into those cells. Some cells have moderate levels, some cells have low levels, some cells have high levels. And we see if we look at acetylated H3 staining that the recovery of staining seems to occur in these cells, roughly proportional to the amount of MYC that's in there, as if the effect of MYC were occurring throughout the nuclei. And this overexpression effect also can occur in tissues. If we make transgenic mice that have moderate and high levels of MYC, of NMIC expressed off the transgene, we get moderate and high levels of acetylated H3 staining, suggesting that the level of MYC is somehow related to the sort of quote-unquote global level of staining. And we can go the opposite way. Here's a nuclei stained from cells stained with acetylated H4 antibody, and we see these are wild-type cells, and we put the MAD protein in, and it goes way down. And if we use MAD that lacks the region, the small 13 amino acid region that interacts with its co-repressor, the decrease is attenuated. We get something of a decrease. There may be other ways that MAD's involved in modifying chromatin, but there's clearly an effect of not allowing the co-repressor to bind. So these look to be very large-scale effects. This is a kind of rogues gallery of cells that Paul sort of put together from these populations of cells that vary in their MYC levels. Right? This was just an acute knockout of MYC, and some cells had survived and had high levels of MYC, others had pretty low levels, and others had none. And it really corresponds quite well to the intensity of the DAPI staining in the nuclei. We see that the nuclei are smaller and that these dense regions, which are generally considered to be heterochromatic, seem to increase in these nuclei. And here's the acetylated H4 staining going down, and in another panel, we couldn't do both antibodies, in another panel with this MYC decrease, we see an increase in the dimethyl K9, the inactive chromatin modification. So it looks like the effects really are occurring, are pretty widespread. And this is just a little electron microscopy to examine this further. In normal control nuclei, you see these islands of heterochromatin that are usually close to the nuclear laminar, to the nuclear membrane area. And here, from some examples of the MYC null cells, you see that now there seems to be more heterochromatin. Even though the cells are smaller, it's a higher percentage of the nuclear area seems to be taken up by heterochromatic regions when we lose MYC. So there's some sort of dose effect, I think, with the amount of MYC and the amount of heterochromatin. So we've gone from thinking, which I mean, you guys maybe never thought, that there were a few rather specific target genes that MYC and MAX interacted with, sort of now thinking that perhaps what's happening is that MYC and MAX are binding to large regions, to many sites in chromatin, and perhaps are acting to define rather large domains that are to make them permissive. So MYC, as I mentioned in the beginning, is not a great transcription factor, and perhaps the reason is that it's not a standard transcription factor. But what it really is a kind of permissivity factor that is binding to regions frequently in chromatin and allowing those regions to be open to other factors, which then would bring in RNA polymerase and allow gene transcription.
But I mean, that is somehow, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Then you're hypothesizing that there are other transcription factors which are succeeding at least parallel to MYC, right? Because so far you haven't found little of any transcription factors, you were saying, as direct targets of MYC. So,
right.
And there must be a whole, I mean, very important other.
Yeah, so for example, so yeah. I think that's very likely. So when you look at a cell in a quiescent state, in a G0 cell, there's no MYC, and you add growth factors, MYC is very rapidly induced. Remember, I said it's an immediate early response. It's one of the very first transcription factors to be induced. So imagine that what MYC does is it becomes induced high levels of there, it sort of binds chromatin, sort of fans out on chromatin, and sort of opens the shop. But these mitogenic signals that you've induced by adding growth factors induce many other transcription factors as well. Right? There are many other transcription factors that come along. And some may come along later in the cell cycle. They may not even be around at those early stages. But if MYC is there and saying, we're open for business, then those factors then can come in and know that these regions are actually defined regions which would be transcribed.
Have you looked on genes like PRD3 and RB and all these checkpoint and or tumor suppressor genes and see if you get these as well? That might be a good control to see.
I mean, RB would certainly be induced in these cells. RB is induced when you enter the cell cycle. That's most RB regulation is post-translational phosphorylation and whatnot, binding by other factors. So a lot of this, that kind of control may not occur at the level of transcription of RB.
I could say you wouldn't expect to see. I mean, certainly you wouldn't expect to see if this is a growth signal and you're saying this is a general growth signal, it's hitting everything that's to do with the growth pathway. But that's the idea, I would say.
I wouldn't say everything. I don't know.
But like a massive amount, yeah, like 20-30%. Yeah. It probably shouldn't be hitting things that. A good control to see if you're getting the right thing. It should not be hitting things that are stopped.
RB has never by anybody been described as a target of MYC.
Well, let's forget
RB,
but I mean like P3, for instance.
Not P3. We have them up. It's not a target of MYC either. Well, actually, that's...
It shouldn't be a target.
I mean, there's, you know... MYC targets have a kind of musty history. You can find a couple of papers out there that say MYC does induce P53. MYC does induce ARF. I don't know.
I mean, according to
it's sort of interesting. You would suggest that there might be two classes of transcription factors. Those like there, which actually prepare the code, and those that don't have to carry ATs and HLATs, right? And they would come down and they would be using the prepared chromatin to turn the gene from threefold to 100-fold, threefold to 10-fold.
But I don't know if carrying HATs or HSAC allows that distinction, because
most of them do.
So I don't think that's an argument you can fall back on. I don't think carrying a hat means you're doing this. I mean, it may be to the extent that you blind. I don't know to what extent actually you're getting really. I mean, the dynamic range of those antibodies, God knows what we're seeing. I mean, it looks all or nothing. It's fairly dramatic. The actual numbers, maybe we don't really know. Right?
So the thing is, I don't know. What I find very intriguing is that this is sort of, the mix is like a positive feedback loop, right? If you get into the chromatin, then you will recruit histone acetylase, and you will open it up more, which will make it easier for more MYC to come in and open it up more, right? Whereas the MAD is a negative feedback loop, right? So if MAD comes in, it deacetylates the histones, which will tend to close up the region in time, which will lead to less MAD binding, right? So you can imagine that this gives rise to some interesting sort of local dynamics where there's this local reinforcement of opening up. Stuff, right?
So right. That's not a question that I think is easy to answer, but in fact, this is an attempt to sort of summarize that, I mean, exactly what you're getting at, nature of this problem, that there seem to be multiple factors binding to these sites. You know, we know there's MYC. MAD is highly controlled, and we see MAD comes on during differentiation. It's not so hard to imagine MYC going off and MAD going on, and then basically MAD shutting down genes that MYC has activated. More complex are the MAD proteins that seem to be co-expressed with MYC, and the MYC protein, which we know is expressed at the same time as MYC. We've done chip assays, and we can essentially find MYC and MYC bound to the same EBOX elements. And I think that there's a dynamic interaction going on. All of these proteins have very short half-lives. They all turn over really fast. And so I think what's happening is that there's a kind of flux going through of these binding sites. I think these proteins are I don't know how to put this in a really coherent way, but are on and off these sites continually, and that there's a continual battle between acetylation and deacetylation that's going on. And maybe the guy who wins is the guy who's there in slight excess, right? Who can just sort of push the sites in a particular direction, and that's sort of enough to let other factors come in and bind.
I wonder to what degree this kind of model, which I like a lot, puts a lot of emphasis on concentration.
Yeah.
And in many of your experiments, you're varying concentration by actively knocking out, putting in. So to what degree is the sort of gross acetylation something that's a consequence of an overexpression or underexpression phenotype, and that in normal conditions, it isn't, you wouldn't see 80% of the genome lighting up with acetyl histones, right? Acetylated. Now, I do realize that, you see these things in knockouts is negative, and then when you increase it, it's positive, but that doesn't happen most of the time. It happens in cancer with the amplifier circuit. It happens in cancer with the
retroviruses. Right.
But under normal conditions, MYC and MAX and MINT are controlled in such a way
that those large changes don't occur. That's right. Yeah. And so the question is, under those conditions, are there these global changes?
Where does the specificity come from under those conditions?
Right. I mean, I guess I would take some umbrage from the fact that the expression in the damn ID experiments is very low. Right. It's not extraordinary overexpression. I think, and actually the experiments that Bruno Amati has done, for example, where he's taken quiescent cells and just added serum and then looked at binding sites, so he didn't look at a vast region, he looked at a lot of binding sites came up with somewhere between 15% and 20% of genes were occupied by MYC or MAX. Those, that was an extrapolation, but those experiments were done under normal MYC conditions. And, or let's not say high overexpression in any case. So I would like to argue that this is actually occurring all the time, and that the binding is, in fact, very widespread under normal physiological conditions. But I think a stringent test of that has not been made. And so maybe knockdown experiments would be actually worth doing to see whether if we can just titrate MYC levels to half the normal amount, rather than do the knockout, which is very gross, right, to see whether we can see a change there. I think that would be very, very worthwhile to do.
But I mean, what sort of puzzles me? I mean, to all people pose this in terms of consensus bias, like CG, but I mean, if you go away from consensus, is it possible that then you see different specificity for this, say, Mad-Max compared with MYC-Max?
So what other binding sites should I look at?
Well, I mean, is it only this consensus, like CACG, TG, that it binds, right? I mean, for example, if you mutate one base, for example, first C, like, from T, then perhaps you may still have binding, right? But then you see difference, for example.
So right? would you be able to distinguish between MYC and MAX? Could you find a DNA binding site where MYC-MAX might bind, but MAD-MAX might not?
Right, exactly, yes.
I don't think if there's any experiment that we or anybody else has done that would address that.
So presumably one could address that using your methylation data for different, you know, say for MAD and MYC, and you know, see if there is something differentiated.
We don't really see. We do see some sites which MAD binds to where we don't see MYC binding and vice versa. I don't know if that's, you know, there is some slop at the edges, and I don't know how real that actually is, and it's never been followed up to any great extent. So I guess I don't know. I don't believe their functions are totally overlapping. I think there's a lot of overlap. But I'm not sure it's total overlap.
So coming back to the Usman thing, did they actually go to the next word, and did it turn out to be, because you can actually push on to other words.
Yeah,
and were there words related to this that showed up there?
Yeah, we actually spent a lot of time trying to chase down sequences that might be other binding sites, and we really had no
luck. You may have been forced to sort of chase sequences that are very different from CACGT. If it is that mutations of the site also have some effect, would you be able to see that as well? That is, two strong sites, one slightly weaker site together is a good thing too.
Nothing in our analysis of that data, nothing like that actually came up.
But maybe you should have put in MYC matrices to begin with, to give it that kind of
evidence. I don't think that's implemented yet.
But you know, you don't have to do it so general. If you want to do one MYC matrix that is best correlated with the data, I don't think that's hard. Okay, no, if you want to do too many, you'll be...
But then you have to run, I don't know, some version of mean, right?
So I can tell you the data is online. The raw data is online. So if anybody wants to get out a shovel and start digging, be my guest.
is the take-home story that all of these six base pair sites that aren't in heterochromatin are bound and active?
I think a large fraction are bound. And active is an interesting issue because what do you mean by active? If you mean by active, are that site equals a gene being turned on somewhere?
Does that site mean you're recruiting hats that are open to DNA?
Well, I believe so.
At all?
I believe so, yes.
And this is most probably too much to ask, but in terms of this picture, it sort of suggests that there is a very, very sharp switch between one state to the other over slight changes of composition in case there is a positive feedback of sorts that you get more histone acetylase, right? And boom, at some point you hit this thing. Do you think, you know, with concentration you can measure expression
or particular importance, or in this business? Is there sort of a very sharp turnover as compared to a single site dominated?
I would tend to think that maybe that's probably what those negative regulators are actually doing, the MAD and the MINTs are actually doing, are actually blunting that sort of sharp effect. Because they're always opposing it. I mean, if their levels don't change.
Right.
But I mean, you would expect if at a certain point MIC is upregulated, right? When you start proliferating, right? MIC shoots up, right? You expect that all of a sudden you get much more chromatin output.
Yeah.
And then if you would do something like this staining that you do for Pol2, right, on the DNA, then you would see that in one state where the MAD max are winning, there is much less on the DNA being actively transcribed than when the MIC max are winning, right? You would expect.
The problem is that those two systems are actually right now not compatible. I can't do the type of DNA staining I did for Pol2 on the cells where I can add serum, but maybe something like that could be set up at some point. You know, right now, it's not an easy experiment to do for technical reasons. So let me just... I think I've talked enough. Just thank the people who in my lab who've been involved in this work, and our collaborators, they've done a lot of this stuff, and this is where we work at the Fred Hutchinson Center in Seattle, and that's our mountain, which I hope it stays asleep.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You said a record.